first, I thought of every step of that iteration, see people, adjust efforts, measure impact, as tactic. I had to really break out of that paradigm and understand that that first step, that see people, is not a tactic. That's an actual way of being in the world, and a way of showing up with other people. And it's driven by curiosity, you know, and a desire to kind of get it right in my diagnosis. And then that then informs the tactics of what adjustments I make, and how I measure impact is determined by what the adjustments were. Sometimes I can measure impact just by seeing the result. I use the example of...
Welcome to the Left of Greg podcast. Hello, and thank you for tuning in to the Left of Greg podcast. I'm Brian Marin, the host and creator of the show. As always, I will be joined by human behavior expert, Mr. Greg Williams, who the show is affectionately named after. Here on the Left of Greg show, our goal is to increase your advanced critical thinking ability through a better understanding of what we call human behavior, pattern recognition, and analysis. If you'd like to find out more about what that is, you can check the episode details. If you have any questions or would like us to cover a specific topic, please reach out to us at leftofgreg@gmail.com. Today we are joined by Chip Huth, a highly respected figure in the law enforcement community who has over 30 years of operational experience. During his career, Chip led an internationally recognized tactical team where he planned, coordinated, and executed over 2,500 high-risk tactical operations. We brought Chip on the show to talk about the transformational changes he brought to his agency through a process created by the Arbinger Institute that focuses on developing an outward mindset. During the episode, Chip talks about the struggles he had and how he learned to see people, which not only changed the way the community viewed his officers, but how it also made them a more effective agency. If you're interested in learning more about Chip or the Arbinger Institute, please check out the links in the episode details. Please don't forget to follow us on social media. You can find the links in the episode details. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please share it with a friend. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy the show. All right. Well, good morning, everyone, and good morning, listeners. Thanks for tuning in today. We have a very, very special guest on the show by the name of Mr. Chip Huth. Chip, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate you coming on the show.
Brian, thank you very much. And Greg, thank you as well for having me.
Yeah. So we've been excited to get you on because we've talked a little bit, for those listeners who heard us talk about it before, a little bit about some of the stuff at folks at the Arbinger Institute. You know, we went out to did some of their training with them and in Salt Lake and this whole outward mindset and how you guys approach stuff. But I would love to kind of get the overview from you, Chip, because, you know, this relates directly to what your role was in law enforcement, which you have an extensive law enforcement career, metropolitan area like Kansas City. So there's a lot that you had to deal with. And you guys kind of took this model that they have and really applied it in some unique ways. And I've even gotten stories from people that know you that said it was pretty impressive, completely outside of this, that we weren't even talking about something like this, and said, hey, what these guys were able to do is really cool. And then fundamentally aligned with how we see things. So for anyone listening, you know, we talk about human behavior and how to articulate it. And one of the first parts of what you guys do with Arbinger and everything you're trying to do is literally called see people. So right away, there was some overlap in what we do. So I'd love to kind of hear from you to give our listeners a little bit of background about what that is.
Yeah, you bet. So, you know, as you mentioned, 30 years I spent in law enforcement, most of that time building and leading SWAT teams. I had the opportunity to serve in every leadership position in the SWAT team from, you know, point man, unit trainer, all the way to special operations division commander. Just a wonderful opportunity to work with some high quality folks doing really special work. And, you know, as you said, you know, I stumbled across Arbinger's work, you know, by happenstance. I was in an airport, Denver International Airport. We were grounded due to high winds, and I stumbled into a bookstore. I think it's called The Tattered Cover. I think it's still there, actually. And I saw this book, Leadership and Self-Deception. And, you know, at the time, I was really struggling because I had taken over the busiest SWAT team in the nation, leading that, you know, as a tactical leader. And I was really failing miserably in terms of connecting with my troops and helping to do the things I was sent there to do, which was improve the relationship with the community. Top of that, my teenage boys wouldn't speak to me, and I was going through my second divorce. So I saw this book, and I'm like, Leadership and Self-Deception. Okay, well, always been a bit autodidactical. I grew up, you know, around books as much as I could. And I recognized self-deception as a philosophical paradox. Didn't know that I really understood it that well, but I kind of knew generally that philosophers had struggled with this for, you know, eons. And then I saw the term leadership, and I was like, how do you smash these two things together in a book title? And finally, the book was thin, so I was sold.
Yeah, there you go. There were some pictures in there, maybe some graphs.
That,
yeah,
that would have made it better. But I did read it, but I totally misinterpreted it. You know, I thought that this book told me what was wrong with all the people in my life that didn't see the world the way I did.
There you go.
My kind of book.
Yeah, right. The exact kind of opposite message that was probably intended. I went so far as to start prescribing it to people in my life that I found difficult. Like, you know, disagree with me in a meeting, you get a book, you know. So, but, you know, eventually my good friend, my brother and future co-author at the time, Jack Colwell, I know you gentlemen are acquainted with Jack, just a fine human being.
He is.
He is as advertised. You know, he is a very genuine soul. And, you know, he was kind of like the chip whisperer. He could come to me and, you know, when I was really resistant to everybody else. And he had a way of pitching things to me. And he invited me to a 2-day workshop. You know, I understand you gentlemen attended a temporary version of that.
Does the way he's approaching you, it sounds like the way he approached us too.
Exactly. So,
that's definitely his MO. I like it because it works.
Yeah,
it's very effective.
Sneak attack, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, very subtle. You know, so he invited me back then. Of course, there weren't PowerPoints or anything. We were drawing stick figures on butcher paper, and that's kind of how it was. And I just remember, like, halfway through that workshop, it hit me like, oh my, they're talking about me in this book. Like, you know, the one thing that hit me, and it still to this day just rattles my cage, is that, you know, I was married to two very different women. They were different in every possible respect. I was the common denominator in both those failed marriages. And, you know, it just rocks me when I think back about it, that, you know, I was so blind to that. That's, you know, plays into the self-deception piece. You know, I can see what's going on with everybody else and what their problem is very clearly, but I'm on the wrong side of my eyeballs. I certainly can't see how I'm contributing to my failures. And so, you know, to shorten this story up a bit, you know, I go through the workshop and I think, wow, you know, there are implications for this, not only in my leadership with my team, which was really, I really need to improve that. I wasn't seeing them as people that mattered. I was seeing them as pieces on a chessboard that I could manipulate to achieve an objective. And of course, they were building their resistance to me into their obedience.
Right.
And there's that. But then there's also this community issue that we had. You know, it's like, why are we getting so many complaints? Well, before I had written it off as, well, it's because we're doing kinetic work. You know, we're knocking down doors. We're flashbanging. We're shooting people's pets occasionally. We're shooting people occasionally. And, you know, all of those things, you know, in my mind, complaints follow that type of work like night follows day. And I just thought that's a consequence of doing that work. And I started thinking more deeply about it with Jack's help and the other folks from Arbinger that kind of wrapped their arms around me metaphorically. And I just thought, well, wait a minute. You know, maybe people aren't responding to what we're doing as much as they're responding to how they're feeling seen by us while we're doing it. And that turned out to be a very, very pivotal insight. Again, I don't take credit for it. That was illuminated for me. But once we started changing the way that we were with people, not what we did tactically, it drastically changed the results that we got in terms of community engagement. And ironically and unforeseen, the amount of drugs, illicit currency, and felony arrests that we got. Like, so those things go up, complaints disappear, and you're like, how does this happen? It's the same people, same tactics, same equipment. You know, all of the things we typically would change, we didn't change any of that. You know, now some things change at the tactical level by virtue of this new way of seeing. I tell you, it was really unexpected. And the last thing I'll say before I flip it back to you guys, who are really the experts in this domain, is that the type of curiosity that is occasioned by this first step of this iteration that we teach, see people, actually helped us improve our threat detection. You know, the idea was, look,
absolutely,
I become curious. I'm not, when I'm like self-absorbed, this is my experience. You guys correct me if I mess any of this up, but in my experience, when I'm self-absorbed, I tend to force my paradigms onto everyone and I tend to make unhelpful assumptions. When I'm more open to the reality of other people, what I tend to notice is anomalies, deviations from baseline in human behavior. Why is that guy wearing a coat in July that's that heavy and long? You know, I start asking questions. Why is he taking a shorter step with his right leg? You know, I mean, and I start seeing things. It's really like, I get excited about this. I apologize, but it's like a whole new world opens up. I'm looking at the world in a different way. It's like I'm inhabiting a different reality. So I'll pause there, but there's a lot to unpack.
Chip, this is so refreshing because I had the occasion that nobody else that I know had where the United States military came to me and said, hey, would you like to take part in this study, which turned into the study meeting a bunch of 3 and 4 stars and saying, hey, we want to change the way the DOD does it. And the Marine Corps saying, we'll be lead. We want to do this, and giving me all these incredible opportunities. And so every room that I went into, I was like, okay, how is it that all of these best of, how is it that all of these subject matter expert things that we learned on the street didn't translate over to these units going into combat? What did they miss? How is the institutional memory didn't carry the best of series along? And so I would say something that we do on the streets in, you know, suburban Detroit, and they would go, well, that's brilliant. We can use that here. And I'm like, wait a minute. All good cops in every city everywhere are doing this. And they're like, no, because we would see evidence of that. So I'll focus on that in a second. But the idea is Jack Caldwell comes up to us and he starts talking about the outward mindset because he read a bunch of our stuff and says, hey, you have training changes behavior, and we call it a change in mindset changes outcome. And I go, yeah, it's the same. It's principally the same. We're just well left to bang when we make most of those decisions. And he goes, can you give me an example? And you know how Jack is. So he's pulling the thread. Well, the same thing that the best of, and I'll credit Jim Mattis for being a General James Mattis is a very forward thinker, but he's not the only one. There was a whole bunch of people in that room, and they brought hundreds of people in to test out and say, what would you do? The first thing I said is, meaning I'm being tested just with all these other subject matter experts, is people are the same all over the world. And I go, well, that's not true at all. Well, yeah, it absolutely is true. As a matter of fact, the very nuanced changes in culture or something like language can be overcome immediately. I mean, on the plane, on the way in, you can fix those things. And then the other thing was, look for the similarities in people, not the differences, because they're more like you than you think. And they want all the same things. And not talking about the trash that Maslow talks about. We're talking about real human engagement, humans talking to humans. That's the job. Yeah. Okay. So you carry a gun. And so what happened is the military morphed to this mindset and said, wait a minute, there's a better way. We can engage. We don't have to boot doors, ram cars, blow people up. We can take a knee and talk to the same people. And you know what? In Iraq, those people were going, don't go down that street. There's a bomb. In Afghanistan, they were going, hey, be advised, in this next paddy dike you're going to go into, there's snipers everywhere. And it's like people were, how were you so affected? Well, when you slow down long enough to talk to somebody, you'd be amazed at how magical those moments can be. And I'll also credit Jack Caldwell for coming up and saying, these are not the drones you're looking for, and doing the mind meld on Brian and I, and when we were in Utah, and he introduced us to Chief Ken Wallentine, another great forward speaker. And so, you know, and we know Brian Willis, and we were just on the phone with Dr. Black. And
John Black,
what happens is you have this small group of innovative thinkers that understand how to reach 3,000 years back and reach upstream till tomorrow and get things done. And you're one of them. The problem is that they don't coalesce. They're not covalent bonds. They're not like when do you come together? So I hate trade shows. Brian and I have only been to one, and I see what it is, and it's not for me. I can tell you that. We try to put out stuff, but who reads a white paper anymore? Us. You know, we read yours, you read ours, we read Brian's, right? So the idea is that you're bringing to bear all of the fantastic stuff that sets you apart from other law enforcement. And there's others like us out there, but I would say out of 15,000 agencies, it's not in every agency. And I would say out of the hundreds of thousands of coppers, it didn't transcend all of them. So how do you stay motivated and focused knowing that a lot of the stuff that you're putting down in print and saying on podcasts like this is getting passed over? How do you equate that?
Well, it's not a very sexy answer. And it's a work in progress for me. I've gone through a journey, over the years. you know, my father was a clinical psychopath and a career criminal, and I inherited some of his psychology, and it's very hard for me to connect with people. Very hard for me to employ empathy, good empathy.
Right.
Distinct between that and empathy that's not so helpful.
Yeah, predatory empathy, right? Yeah, I get that. We've all had similar upbringings, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I've been working for years to focus on loving people. And I know it sounds like, you know, like, sounds like so soft, right? But this idea of employing compassion toward other people and trying to just, you know, I heard love once defined by a speaker as the desire to see unnecessary suffering ameliorated. And I thought, you know, if I see someone as a human being, suffering's the price they pay for existence. I mean, the world is, there's a lot of it and a little bit of us, and we're going to bump up against it. We're going to hurt. It's a matter of degree. But I don't want to see people suffer foolishly or needlessly. And so when I think about love that way, this is what I say to myself all the time. When, you know, you talk about the frustration sets in, I say, don't allow this person to deprive you of your opportunity to love them. You know, they're going to test you. You know, that's good. I mean, I've been on the other side of that. If you talk to my wife, I probably tested her yesterday. You know, yeah. I mean, we're all as you guys so eloquently have pointed out in the tactical domain. I mean, at a fundamental level of analysis, we are the same.
Yeah.
You know, we really are. And I think what keeps me coming back is like every once in a while you meet people like, you know, you gentlemen who get it. And then, you know, I'll meet people from different fields that get it. And I'm thinking like, if all these different people with these different paradigms, perspectives, you know, ideologies and ideas, disciplines, if we're converging on this concept, it's, you know, there's something really valuable there. And I wanted to say one thing. It was funny when you were talking about, people over the world being the same. I like to watch people. I'll go to a movie theater and I'll get there early and I'll sit back and I'll just watch people. And what I'm looking for, and you guys will probably appreciate this, I'm looking for baseline behavior in a movie theater.
Mm-hmm. Yep, like,
absolutely. What do people in that context do? You know, they're checking their phone, they're looking at the menu, they're chit-chatting. And I'm saying, where do I see an anomaly? Like, once in a while, you see a cop in line, will be looking behind him.
Yeah.
You know, turning around, you know. It's like, okay, so that might be
or a criminal. Yeah.
Or a criminal. Yeah. We don't want to get into the similarities there.
Yeah, no.
So I was in Mexico last week working in central Mexico. I was in León temporarily. I went to a Walmart to get some bottled water. If you're ever in León, go to the Walmart, get a bottle of water. I come out and there's a little Dairy Queen there. And so I grabbed me a banana split and I sat down with my back to the Dairy Queen on outside of this little patio area. And I start watching people. And I speak second grade Spanish. And so I really don't understand the language, but I'm sitting back and I'm just watching the people.
Right.
I'm watching them interact with their kids. I'm watching them go in the store. I'm watching the couples walk by. And, you know, if you were to mute the language, you could be anywhere in the world.
Exactly.
Their behaviors, the way they talk. I could literally intuit what was happening between a child and their mother based just on the facial expressions and the body language, not even knowing what, although I did understand the word cayete. I think that means shut up. I think, but the way she spoke it. So I just, when you said that about people and the commonalities between people, that was just one illustration in my recent past where I was like, oh my, like this keeps getting reinforced to me. Now
exactly.
The question becomes, what are the implications? And I'll throw that back to you, gentlemen.
Right. No. And we, you know, cause one of the sayings we like to use to really summarize is, you know, you don't have to speak the language to read the writing on the wall, right? You don't have to know something to go, I got it. I got the situation. I'm 5,000 miles from my home and where I grew up, but I get it. This is a world of different language and culture, but okay. And getting through that, it either takes some sort of training or some experience where you have light bulb kind of moment, like in what you talk to it, you know, when you're in this bookstore, I see this book and then I love the reaction is like, oh God, I got to give this to some people to read. Cause they could really, that's the best. I love that. When I've had people, you know, do that too, we're like, oh yeah, there's more people should really take your course because they said, and then by like the second day, they're like, hey, you know, I'm starting to realize that my own actions really did a negative influence in the situation, and they feel bad. And it's like, look, man, like you didn't know that at the time. You were being trained to do what you did. You were mimicking those who trained you. Like,
exactly.
Now you, we have the recognition there. Okay, good. That's the first step. But what it, you know, what one of the most difficult things for a lot of folks to do, which you kind of seem to do, which took you, it sounds like it took you some time, is when you have this, because you guys with the Arbiter has a very simple, you know, it's boiled down to a simple thing of see people, adjust efforts, measure impact. Well, that's, which is phenomenal, because you can boil it down to those three elements, but then you could spend the rest of your life really diving into what that is, right? Which I love stuff like that, where you boil it down to some simple message, but it has so much meaning behind it. But what it took you a while, what you realized, you know, you finally did what I call the Taylor Swift, where you do the, hey, you know, it's me, I'm the problem, it's me. You know, you realize, like, you do the, oh, wait a minute, I'm the one here. And what you're
I'm not sure she's actually genuine. So
I know you don't know this, but let's not go there. I'm a huge Taylor Swift fan.
No. Exactly. Listen, I am too, but I pay real attention to her lyrics, and I'm pretty sure she's just kind of leading on these guys. I don't know.
Maybe
like they think they got a shot.
So funny.
Well, yeah, exactly. So then when you did it, so you kind of took this model, you took this outward mindset of looking at things, but it's not, you know, you personally is always, I say, the most difficult one. We teach a lot of external stuff, because what we're really doing is talking about all human behavior. But if I get you, Chip, to go look at, see those other people, this is how we articulate that. Eventually, over time, you're going to get to the point where you go, hey, wait a minute. It's not just about those people out there, right? You got to give people the breadcrumbs. But what I love about what you did is you said, wow, this is how it affects me personally, then organizationally at the police agency, but then literally down to the tactical level. And where we go, it's like, look, your tactics, techniques, and procedures, they're probably good enough. They're going to change over time as you learn new methods and things. That's fine. But what aren't we focusing on? What aren't we doing here? You know, what we because that's what we teach, is we provide a think with a K, not a thing with a G, right? You got all the things on your uniform and vehicle. Like, let's provide this think. And so how did you finally, or was there something that led you to realize, like, wait a minute, this isn't just about this one thing. This has this universal approach to it that I can use literally and in any situation, whether it's tactically, operationally, strategically, organizationally, looking at myself in the mirror. How did you get to sort of that point, or when did you realize that?
Yeah, I think it was a kind of a process, actually. But at first, I thought of every step of that iteration, see people, adjust efforts, measure impact, as tactic. Mm-hmm. I had to really break out of that paradigm and understand that first step, that see people, is not a tactic. That's an actual way of being in the world. And a way of showing up with other people, and it's driven by curiosity, you know, and a desire to kind of get it right in my diagnosis. And then that informs the tactics of what adjustments I make, and how I measure impact is determined by what the adjustments were. Sometimes I can measure impact just by seeing the result.
Right.
I use the example of this morning on the weight pile, you know, so see people. Well, other people are going to come use this gym when I'm done. They're probably busy. They're trying to squeeze in a workout. You know, they're wanting a sanitary place to work out. They're not wanting to get sick. They're, you know, what have you, right? Well, you know, what would it be like to be those people and come in here and see that sweat on the bench I just left? And then, so that's, once I can start identifying with the future, you know, those people that are the people that are going to be in there in the future, right? Now I can adjust efforts. I clean the bench, you know, and sanitize the bench. And then measure impact is there's no sweat on the bench.
Right.
And the trash that I use to clean the bench is in the trash can, not the floor. So, like you mentioned, this is an iteration that I run numerous times a day, from eating out at restaurants to, you know, observing people at movie theaters to working out. And so it just occurred to me, like, I thought, if I'm forcing my biases, prejudices, and loyalties onto other people in all these high stress contexts, if I'm thinking, you know, like, well, these are the type of people that are armed, then I'm totally excluding all the other potential people that are armed. And it hit me really hard. I was talking to a police officer, and he had responded to a traffic accident on Ward Parkway here in Kansas City. So Ward Parkway, if you haven't been here, is kind of a very rich area. A lot of mansions up and down Ward Parkway. When presidential candidates come to town, they'll hold fundraisers there. It's kind of like a Central Park West of Kansas City, right? And so he said, you know, I responded to an accident on Ward Parkway. You get a lot of these because the way the parkway flows. And he's, you know, he admitted he's a bit complacent about it. And so I got more complacent when I pulled up And one of the guys that was in a wreck was in a BMW. He's wearing a suit. And, you know, I have a certain bias for people in BMWs wearing suits. And I admit, in retrospect, I kind of lowered my caution flag and I come up and we're kind of getting some stuff together. My partner and I are talking to the guy. I go back to the car to get some cones. I hear gunshots. And he said, there was this disconnect mm-hmm. where I'm just standing still thinking, like, why would there be gunshots on Ward Parkway in the middle of the day? You know, we're at a traffic accident. He says, and then when I looked around, this guy was shooting at my partner. And he said, it took me it felt like forever, mm-hmm. you know, probably seconds to engage. He goes, and what I kept thinking was, this is not the kind of guy that shoots at the police.
Yep.
And he goes, and I just couldn't break out of that. It was, you know, it felt like I was like walking in muck. I couldn't like break out of that for a second. And he goes, it scared me to death. And you know, it scared me to death because I thought, you know, my situational awareness based on my prejudices, my biases just went away to the point that, as you know, seconds in a gunfight, are you kidding me? Right. If I gave you 2 seconds in a gunfight, you'd take that in a heartbeat.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so things like that, to answer your question, started getting me really interested in going, wait a minute. There's something really powerful here that goes beyond just helping people feel seen in a leadership context. Or helping people feel valued as human beings, or something beyond that. There's actually this, like, if I see you as a person, then I appreciate the full range of your humanity. I appreciate exactly. your capacity within that full range. And then I can start being informed by the kind of things you gentlemen teach, you know, yeah. which are actual observable behaviors that I can filter, you know, independent of my biases. It actually helps me, I think, you correct me here, but I think what you're doing helps me overcome my bias.
Yeah, and Chip, first of all, your story is so poignant and so simple that everybody's got to replay this section. Our listeners, the viewers, go back to the section, listen to it again. Chip, I'll tell you, I try to be a humble guy, but I like me sometimes, and that's important to me. But I'll tell you that the thing I'm most proud of occurred back in the late 70s, early 80s, when I developed baseline plus anomaly equals decision, based on my work on heuristics. Back then, people had no idea what heuristics were. And I was sparring with all the greatest in the world on it because I was just a street kid going, no, you're getting it wrong. Heuristics are what's damning us into these inevitable decisions. And they're always bad. Why? Because they're all biased and they're all leading down the path of least resistance because they're easy. And so you can't look at a person and put your values on that person. And then when they differ from your values, you say that's an anomaly. That's not an anomaly. What you got to do is you got to have a tabula rasa baseline that's based on the environment and the situation and the timing, and all these other factors. And what you do is then you start placing the stuff like Barbie's dream house, the furniture in, and then you see the way that it sets and which room needs the carpet and everything. Now, you take anybody and you put them in that Barbie dream house. Now you've got a baseline and we watch what normal behavior is clinically, right? And then the people that stick out are always one of two things. They're the best guy in the room. They're the copper because he's trying to keep the security guard, trying to keep people safe, right? The soldier. Or you got the vicious criminal that's sizing up their next hit, what I'm going to steal. So if you can, because remember, you said it perfectly. We've got to give people the gift of time and distance in a combat context, in a very kinetic world, approaching the X. And it's not binary. You can't sit there and say, well, shoot, don't shoot. Well, in this situation, it's right and wrong. Well, these are all black and white decisions. None of that fits. So you got to fix you before you go into that situation. And you know, I've spent 40 years trying to get people to listen to that. And people still don't listen. They're like, yeah, well, if that guy wouldn't have done that, if they weren't the proximate cause, and if these people, and you know what? Now, guess what? All you're doing is living that script over and over and over on each new call. So that's another reason I got to be honest. One of the reasons we love your work is your work is self-aware. I swear, if I hear one more person talk about the imposter syndrome or create a new bias that hasn't been on the book, just to talk about it, what you are is you're a genuine human. That's people sense the irony here. Everybody on this call has been divorced. Chip, I think you've got the record so far. But the idea is why? Right. Because we're still searching. Because we're broken effing humans that are trying to get through a very sometimes tough world. Chip, is it a fair assessment that you've eaten at a Salvation Army or slept on the floor a homeless center or done those. I know I have. I know Brian has. The idea is that those experiences and interacting with humans, and specifically in extremis, which you've done for 35 years, what that does is that makes the focus, the onus, less on me and more on the community. And I think if people miss that, they need the bitch slap of reality to bring it back around, because it's not about me. It's about everybody around me, you know? And I love your work, because your work tends to show that. And I don't mean to apply your work or to paraphrase what you say, but do you get where I'm going, Chip? Do you see what I'm trying to say there?
Yeah, I totally get where you're going. You made me think of one of my favorite philosophers, Mike Tyson, when he said, everybody's got a fight plan until I punch him in the face.
Exactly. Right.
It's like the world, you're either going to be humble or the world's going to humble you.
Yep.
And I think we've all experienced both of those to some degree. I'm interested in, I have an acquaintance, Dr. Gary Klein.
Yep.
And Gary, he's talked a bit about heuristics and things of that nature. I'm interested in getting your gentleman's opinion on this. It sounded like you were a little anti-heuristic in the sense of it's not the optimal. I think personally, by the way, I think that some of the people that I've read, like Jonathan Haidt and some of his contemporaries, will say we are intuitive creatures. We make decisions irrationally and then try to justify them post hoc. I see what he needs there, and I understand it, but I think we give rationality short shrift. I feel like we developed this capacity to be rational and to think tactically for a reason, and I think we can train ourselves to be more reasoned and not rely totally on these heuristics and intuition. But Gary, Dr. Klein, I'm sorry, Dr. Klein in his work suggests that there is a place, a time and a place for intuitive decision making, especially when there's low discretion time. So right. I'm going to throw that back at you, gentlemen. And
I'll start and I'll pass it to Brian. So Gary Klein and I used to be very good friends. I'm sure that if you ask him, because you're his good friend, he won't remember me. But we worked together at the University of Central Florida on a project called TADMIS, Tactical Decision Making Under Stress. One of my dear friends who's now on our board, Dr. Joan Johnston, was on that, and a bunch of other critical thinkers. I was not the critical thinker. I was the self-taught Gladwellian outsider that they brought in as part of the process. And here's what I know about heuristics, and you can study the rest of your life, and there's so many different heuristics you can waste a lot of time on. There's template and prototypical matches. A template match is the exact same thing. A prototype is close enough, cognitively close enough, to spur you into a decision. So decisions in extremis, and I was on small unit decision making and a bunch of other programs for DARPA and IARPA and for the DOD, all where Gary Klein was in that same orbit. Gary's work is brilliant. Gary's work goes on a shelf. Now, with his shadow box and some of the new projects, he's going out and reaching out and changing that. But all the stuff that was back then, I was in a combat zone embedded with the U.S. Army sniper team or with the United States Marine Corps on the ground, going house to house in the streets. And so I kept, coming back with information and saying, hey, these things are right and these things are flawed. And I'll give you a very brief example. All humans respond to external stimulus the same exact way. If they don't, they've got a mental problem or they're up to something, right? So in your environment, when things are occurring and you see these heuristics start to line up and they fit the situation, that's when you got to do the mental etch-a-sketch and go, wait a minute, I have to make sure that this is actually what I'm reading. Because bad guys, well, for example, earlier I was talking about the predatory empathy. People nowadays, and I came up with that term 35 years ago, now they call it grooming. Well, what's predatory empathy? My uncle was predatory empathy. He would come over, hey, big guy, come on over this and that, and I would get molested. So I got to read that early on. So that became a prototypical match on a heuristic where when I was on the street and I saw it, I go, that looks a lot like what I had. That looks like my experience. So what Gary Klein got right is that your tacit knowledge can feed forward and make a heuristic a powerful lens. But the problem is that we're trying to teach it as a check in the box.
Yeah.
And that's not how humans are. Yeah. Not all humans have those same experiences. So what Brian and I try to do is train you on seeing the world through your lenses. Because if you see it through my lenses, the glasses don't fit right.
Yeah.
And maybe you don't understand. You get what I'm saying? So all we're doing is trying to change your perspective, open your eyes and your brain to what those things mean generally. Okay, I'm a generalist, and then what they mean specifically
within
Klein's a specificist. You see? Yeah. So we love Klein. We got nothing against Gary Klein. The problem is, though, that he some people continue to think that their stuff is out of our orbit because we published first or we came up with an idea or this or that. You know, I tell people Left a Bang was the greatest after action review any of my students ever wrote. Am I sore that somebody wrote a book on my theory? No, I'm proud of that. I'm humbled that they thought it was amazing enough and a bunch of people bought that book. And that's the same way I feel about Klein. Klein's a critical thinker, but Klein's always trying to push stuff towards a decision point. What we're trying to say is that this decision point is going to be inevitable. How far before it can you influence a positive spin on that? You know,
and Brian, to, no, no, and what you talked about, Greg, is what we do is rather than here learn this framework in a sense and learn what this is. It's you here's the elements. Okay, here's what you have to figure out what those elements mean to you. So, Chip, you have so much tacit knowledge, and I tell this to every law enforcement officer I'm ever in front of. You have more tacit knowledge in your trigger finger than most people have in their whole body. You just don't know it because we haven't maybe put words to our experiences. We don't know how to articulate it. So we're still learning as we go. It's still almost discovery learning, right? And so what Greg was talking about, the template and prototype matches, you can tell a rookie officer coming up right now, Chip, and go, you can tell them every one of your experiences, every one of your stories, but it's not going to be real to them. So they're not going to recognize that in the moment. They have to develop their own. But what you can do is give them, here's the elements from that I saw coalesce. So don't worry about the exact, this is the situation, there was this many people, this was the caliber of weapon, this was the type of vehicle. It's like, no. These few elements started to coalesce. And that, if I had known that then, I would have been able to mitigate this or I wouldn't act sooner. So now what I do is a new guy going, okay, well, I have different experiences, so I have to make that real to me. So what we focus on in our training is here's what that element means to you. So here's what heuristics are. Give me an example of this. Here's what urban masking and social camouflage looks like. Do you have one? Oh yeah, I saw a guy and one time he did this. Got it. So now you have a term, but it's your story, not my story and my definition of what it is. And that builds on that tacit knowledge and that subject matter expertise, because those heuristics that people develop, especially in law enforcement, they're really, they are essential, and they will, if you don't develop them, you could die. I mean, really, you have to develop certain ones, and you just have to understand that there are certain cognition biases that are going to affect our decision-making and our judgment. So I have to balance it. I can't do anything about it in the sense that, like, you know, there's no thing that you're going to get rid of that bias. So that's not possible. But you can balance it with an understanding, a mindset like this, that, right? That's the whole outward mindset. Well, all right, let me see this person. Let me take a step back. So the perfect story you gave earlier, right? You're in the rich neighborhood. Guy fits the baseline for what you should expect to see. Got the Beamer, got the suit. It never got to that issue of, man, this might be something, there might be something else going on. Now change the neighborhood, change the car, change the behavior slightly on that individual. Would those officers then gone like, hey man, I wonder if this guy's got a gun in the car. I wonder if he's got this, right? We should check that even though it's a traffic accident. But so I have to be able to balance that and go, these are possible anywhere. It's why anyone is surprised at these situations. Everyone sees on the news constantly gas stations getting robbed. And then when they go to a gas station, they're shocked that they got robbed. I mean, it's like the number one place where these things happen. And you always go there because why? Because you've been filling up your gas tank your whole entire life and you never took a second to take a look around and they came right up to you. So it's like, even Chip, though we see it, it's still not real to us until it actually
happens. It's so funny. They're building two new gas stations right down from my house. My wife and I never complain of having to drive to get gas because you know, gas stations tend to attract trouble. They're building two right across the street from each other, just a block from me. But you know, it's so interesting. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to actually cut you off.
Go ahead.
Just before you start that, Chip, what I'm trying to say is this is what Brian and I felt when we went to Arbinger. First of all, we're different than every client that went to Arbinger. No, we weren't. We came in, thinking there was a preconceived set. No, we didn't. We came in to observe, and Jack was great about it. He left us alone, didn't play with us, didn't interview us in between everything. And we sat there and we said, well, this is our program, just from a different perspective, right? None of the stuff in Arbinger is a jack in the box where all of a sudden there's the epiphany moment on the X. You can't do that. Life is not like that. You're so far behind. In a nanosecond, in this type of environment matters. So I want to give a shout out briefly and then turn it back over to you, Chip, because Arbinger changed our outlook on some training, because some training that we've attended blows and it was horrible. It blows like the trumpeter in the Army band. And I take nothing away from it. And Brian Willis always says, well, there's always something you can take away from training. Yeah, that it's bad sometimes, right? But Chip, Brian and I held Arbinger in such high esteem because we could see the epiphany moment in the crowd. And we had all different experiences in that crowd. And everyone, the light bulb came on at a different thing. And we heard the little pop, 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 pop. And it was fun. So I'm saying that transformative heuristics, seeing the gas station, can blind us that there's danger. I'm saying that seeing the suit can be a prototypical match that blinds you that this guy might have a gun. And your work, you approach it the same way. It's just you don't sit there and pick out those different points. One of your stories, and Chip, if you don't mind, I think it's your story about the guy with the damage to his leg when you guys were in the house, and it was like, sit down right away. To me, I was in the class. That was my epiphany moment. I go, oh, my God, I've been there. Now, nobody but Brian and I know that. Is that okay to share?
Yeah, it's perfectly okay to share. I'm going to come back around because I got a question for you. You're pulling this string. Matter of fact, can we put a pin in that? Let me ask this question. I don't know where this is going to go.
Yeah.
I just really want your opinions on this. I'm so sorry. So we talked about this idea of the Ward Parkway incident, that traffic crash where the officer's bias was people in suits don't shoot at the police.
People in suits with
the BMW. It was the environment. It was the type of vehicle. Exactly. It was the location.
And the street.
All of
and the time of day.
Time of day. Yep. Yeah.
So here's my question. I want to see what you think of this. I've been thinking about this myself. If we flip that, can that contribute to overreaction on the part of the officer? If I'm in a neighborhood where I'm like, the neighborhood's classically dangerous, this gentleman fits the profile of who I think a criminal, he's driving the type of car I think criminals drive. He's, you know, carrying himself or dressed the way I think criminals dress. And then if that's my heuristic, if I can use that word, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
If that's what that is, can that lead to overreaction? That's the question I wanted to ask.
That's why cops are shooting people when they don't need to be shooting people. Listen, if you talk a cell phone into a cop's or into a suspect's hand, it's a cell phone. There's a shooting this morning, yesterday, a subject named Cole that was killed a little while ago, but it's coming up for review now. And the young man, Cole, was having a problem, and the officers came on the scene, and Cole had a black magic marker in his hand, but he was going, this is on, it's on, let's go, and was coming up on the coppers, and the coppers felt that they were threatened. Okay, if we took that situation and we slow time down, and now we're behind cover, and we understand the totality of the circumstance, those are great, but we're not going to be able to ends justify or go back in time. So what we have to do is we have to change training. This is where we're talking about training in our realm all the time on our podcast, is because what it is in training is we have a dilemma and we solve it at the end of a gun. So are you surprised that all my thoughts when I roll up on an unknown trouble are about a gun? So the idea is what we have to do is understand that every situation is different, and it feeds us little bits of information along the way. But we're in such a hurry to get there as coppers, well, hey, dispatch, we're on the scene, let's handle this, that we shorten the time distance gas, space-time, literally space-time. And what happens now is we go with a poor decision and we stick with it. And that's the difference. There's more of Klein's decision-making work right there. If you have more time and if you're in a position where the stakes are lower, you'll make better decisions. So we as coppers have to force other coppers to think that way too. Stop rushing into the scene. Stop going at the end of your knife, gun, or anything. So I would tell you this. I'm looking at that guy with the BMW downtown Detroit, and he's on Woodward, pulled over to the side of the street, and he gets out of his car for a traffic accident. I'm going, okay, big time. Where's the cocaine? Where's the gun? But that's not a fair assessment. So I've come to that, and every word out of my mouth and my stance and my way of handling that call is now going to be different. But if you approach with tabula rasa and you say, this incident, it's all new, it's all fresh, and things start adding up to it, if you start with a baseline, you can never be wrong. Because baseline against, look, any trip, I'm not teaching you anything. I'm talking to the viewers. You take the known, you take the unknown, and you have to compare them against something. The baseline is the perfect comparison. You'll be right more than you're wrong. Because if you're measuring it against you and your personal experiences and the way Uncle Paul acted and the food that you ate last night that was bad and you didn't get enough sleep, then you're going to give a shitty response. And that citizen and that community is going to hate the cops. We know that. We know that's the truth. You made a difference in Kansas City, Missouri. you made a difference, a palpable difference. People still talking about it. Brian and I had a guy in class last week that couldn't stop talking about you. That's fantastic to us. So we're not doing this to get a pat on the back. We're doing it at the time because it's the right thing to do. So you're spot on. You change just a few elementals and the entire situation changes. And that needs to be taught at the academy.
Yeah, I think it's worth saying too, and this isn't false humility, but you know, I credit the team, the men, and they were all men at the time that were on that team, because yes, I introduced the concept clumsily, and yes, I was still struggling with it too, but they were the ones that put their faith in me. Mm-hmm. And went against their instincts and said, you know what, we're going to actually see what this is about. Let's see what this unconditional regard for people is actually about.
That's so true.
And they actually did, and with each other and then with the community. So I always want to kind of shift credit back to them, because without them, we wouldn't be having this conversation. You know, I'd be one guy wandering around the woods, you know, with an idea, you know, that I picked up from somebody else, which is my own.
And you could have easily, Chip, you could have easily turned into Ted Kaczynski, you know what I'm saying, the Unabomber, and been writing manifestos, right? But, well, but the idea is you didn't. You didn't.
I'm not that good at math. I'm not that good at math.
That's so funny.
You know, it was funny. I people like, I make this comment all the time. Like, I'm actually friends with my first wife now. We had dinner together when I was in Dallas. So she lives in Dallas now. We had dinner together a few weeks ago, and I was like, I told her, I said, you know, it's amazing how much nicer you became when I quit being a jerk.
Here we go again, right?
You completely changed, right? So that story you were talking about, though, look, that story was the very first time that I ever attempted to use a framework that Arbinger taught me called the influence pyramid. And it's just basically a framework to help discipline your thinking around how to influence people productively, not a tactic necessarily, but it kind of undergirds the tactics, you know? Certainly. So the idea being, I could be the best tactical communicator in the world. I could know all the right phrases, ask all the right questions. But if I have contempt or disregard for you, your humanity, you're going to pick up on that.
Yeah.
And it's going to undermine everything I do right at the behavior level. So the influence pyramid, I learn it in a workshop. And I'm out on a search warrant, and it was one of those things. We were hitting a house for homicide, and they had a couple guys they wanted us to scoop up. So they got a drug warrant, and we go into the house under the pretense of looking for drugs, which we find. And we also find one of the suspects, and I think it was a witness, I think, to the homicide. And so we get in there, we get everybody secured, and we're starting to process the scene, starting to exploit the scene, right? So we're in that phase two where things are not kinetic. And the suspect walked up to the house just to kind of see what was going on. And the trailer team picked him up. They recognize him, they stop him, and they bring him into the house. And so I asked him to sit down on the couch, you know. We were gonna detain him. Obviously, we cuffed him. So we're gonna sit down on the couch and wait for the homicide detectives. He goes, "Yeah, I'm not sitting down on the couch." And, you know, my instinct was like, you know, I don't know if you know who I am. Like, I'm kind of in charge here.
Exactly.
And like, and I'm thinking like, you're handcuffed and I'm 235 pounds at the time. Yep. And I'm pretty sure you're going to sit down on the couch. Like, these things are running through my head. Right. So I was brought up in I became a cop in 91. Right. Ask, tell, make. And that was the paradigm that I was telling her. Ask, tell, make. I asked. And, you know, now the next step is to tell. And sometimes that gets smooshed together with make. But I stopped for a second. I thought, well, got this framework I just learned. They didn't teach it dealing with a homicide suspect in a drug house.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, let me just think. One of the principles was, if something you're doing at one level isn't working, the answer is generally at a lower level. And this framework is kind of built up in a pyramid. And the top level is correct. And so I recognize I'm correcting him right now. He's doing something I don't want him to do. I'm trying to give him a correction. That ain't working. So I drop down in my mind, and the next level below is teach and communicate. Like, if your correction isn't working, maybe you haven't clarified expectations. Maybe you need to explain why you want what you want. Okay. So I said, well, sir, let me explain to you. If you're standing up, everyone's going to want to stand up. And we've got to be loading equipment in here, Pelican cases, all kinds of stuff. You'll be in the way. It'll be harder for us to get this job done. And, you know, it's just going to delay everything. It's going to take longer if you get downtown, talk to the detectives. You know, I really explained it. And I remember there were a couple of patrol officers looking at me like I was crazy. But I explained to him, and he looks at me and he says, "Yeah, whatever, man, I'm not sitting down." And I'm like, "Oh, well, this ain't working very well. Like, now I should just knock him down, right? Like, I checked the box. I did my duty. You know, now I can go back to knocking him down, which, if I'm honest with you, is what I really wanted to do anyway.
Yeah.
You know, that's where I was at in my mind. And, but I thought, you know what? I'm here. You know, I mean, I'm here. This is like a laboratory at this point. I'm going to stay with this framework. So the next level down from teach and communicate is listen and learn. So if your teaching and communicating isn't working, maybe you haven't properly diagnosed for you prescribe, right? So I just simply said to the guy, the only thing I could think of, I said, "Hey, man, why won't you sit down?" He says, "Well, I'll tell you why. I was shot a couple of weeks ago. I got 7 pins in my knee. If I sat down and bend my knee, the doc said the pins are popping out. I'm going to have 3 more surgeries. I'm not doing that for anybody." That's and he brilliant. Peppered in a couple.
Yeah.
Split it
yeah.
I didn't care. Mm-hmm. I'll clean that up. But like when he said that, like, I can't explain the feeling that washed over me. Like, some people might call it empathy, right? but I was kind of like, what would it be like?
Yeah.
Here comes the curiosity part, right?
Yep.
To be shot up and not want to sit down and be in that kind of pain. And so I just simply was like, all of a sudden, new alternatives came to my mind at that adjust efforts level of that framework, right? Of the SAM framework. They just kind of, those two frameworks kind of came together. And I was like, well, if we pull this like chair over here and put it next to the couch, we can put your leg up on it, you know, we'd sit down. And he goes, "Well, yeah, I'll do that." And so we pull the chair over. He sits down, has his legs straight, and no problems.
Yeah.
And the coolest part about that story that you guys may not know is he goes down to talk to the detectives. First, he didn't go to the hospital, and we weren't accused of abusing him. And he didn't tell the neighbors 100 different versions of, you know, how the cops beat him up and tore his knee up. And we didn't have to set him at the hospital or face a lawsuit and all the things that could have happened if I would have just shoved him down. And I point out, I would have been within my right to do that, right? Legally, right?
Yeah.
Lawful, but awful. And so, you know, so that doesn't happen. But then the detectives call me up. I won't say his last name, but Eric. And Eric calls me up and he says, "Hey, Chip," he goes, "that guy that we pulled down here, he flipped, he confessed, and he actually implicated somebody else. And, you know, I just wanted to tell you, normally when you guys bring people down for us, when you take them down, all they want to talk about is how bad you guys treated them. Like, we can't get past the fact that, you know, they were handcuffed to a radiator, or they peed their pants, or, you know, whatever it was." Right. He goes, "So whatever you guys are doing, it's working, because this guy, you know, like, he didn't have anything bad to say about you guys." And I thought, man, this is a pretty cool outcome. That story has been pivotal to me and informing me of, like, you know, again, this wasn't like we bust in the door and people are reaching for guns. There was plenty of time here to have a conversation with this gentleman. And, you know, just using that time, I think that story is instructive for a lot of reasons.
And you brought up something that you brought it up a couple times throughout is something, you know, I'd love to kind of highlight is, you know, we're not just talking about this as, you know, lovey dovey, let's all be kind to each other. And, you know, and that's important, and to have empathy. But, you know, when you're a lot of type A type personalities, men and women who are military, law enforcement, whatever, you know, it can be kind of hard for them. But if you look at it, you know, this is something that benefits you operationally as well. I mean, not just in the sense that, yes, you're doing good for others and that's building good relationships, and over time that's going to help. But I mean, literally that helps with the case, that helps us see people in the situation where it's not just something that's catastrophic, but there's an opportunity, because we always put it in the way is, you know, like literally our course, we'll call it navigating high risk, you know, human encounters, identifying prevent indications of danger or opportunity, because it's the same thing. You gave so many examples of that, of what we call, you know, both sides of the coin. Hey, here's what I'm doing, but here's what also I'm doing. It's helped me accomplish my job better, and it's long-term making goals. So it's that when you look at it from the same concept, it's not just, oh, I got to take back and I got to work on me. It's like, yeah, you do. That's good. We can all work on ourselves, you know, in different ways and identify what our weaknesses are. But for the most part, most people are doing the job that they're, you know, how they were trained to do it and are doing just fine at it. So it's not even that. It's just look at it as beneficial. Almost be selfish about it. It's like, well, you're going to gain a lot out of this personally.
I agree.
Well, this is what I believe, because of the ways we are interconnected fundamentally.
Yeah.
I can't help you without helping me. Mm-hmm. And I really can't hurt you without hurting me. It's a matter of degree and extent. And if the need is huge enough, I'll hurt you. And what does that do to me? It changes me in some way, but the trade-off is worth it if it's a school shooter.
Right.
You know, of course. But the trade-off isn't worth it if I'm just abusing people by virtue of having a position of power. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mentioned empathy. We've talked about it a couple of times. I actually got invited to co-author an article on empathy. And I've been working on it on the planes, plural. And I've started over three times, because the more I started writing about the importance of empathy, I started realizing, like, look, really what I want to write about is compassion, because mm-hmm. empathy,
right.
There's a time and place where empathy can be a positive force, but oh my, empathy is also what causes all the secondary trauma in law enforcement officers and paramedics and firefighters.
Of course it does.
You know, there's a dark side to that. And I think, you know, what I'm really talking about is what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. It's just simply compassion, being able to have a desire here to help this human being that's in front of me experience the natural consequences of their decision, but in a way that doesn't cause unnecessary suffering, right?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to pile on. The necessary consequence of him being arrested is he's got to go face whatever he's got to face. And the natural consequence of him putting his hands on me is he's going to have force used on him. But everything else being equal, in that situation, what was called for was getting curious, getting closer to what was actually going on, and responding compassionately. And it's one of those things that I think that when you try to talk to a lot of hardcore law enforcement or military folks about, I'm going way outside of my depth here, but I think there's a inherent vulnerability people feel, like an insecurity, mm-hmm. and it manifests in really tough people, which really baffles me. But I think about our lives, the lives that you, the three of us share, the way we were raised. I mean, I'm just like, man, we've had some of the same experiences. You mentioned Salvation Armies and mission, like, oh my. You mentioned abuse, oh my. But I'm thinking, like, for some reason, we become formidable in the wake of all those things that happened to us. Rather than shrivel up and hide in the corner or become perpetual victims, we decide instead to become formidable intellectually, physically, spiritually. And then I think lurking deep inside is some of that unresolved insecurity. And if you can't conquer that, you end up projecting it out to other people. And so I think, I feel like compassion is something worth pursuing, understanding. And the last point I'll make, and Brian, you said this is a lifelong project. Mm-hmm. This isn't like I reach an end. It's like working out. You don't work out, get in shape, and stop working out.
No.
Yeah. Like you know, atrophy one day, kick right. in, right? Yeah. So it's the same thing. This self-development, you know, Greg, you mentioned self-awareness. This is something I think that is it's a moving target. We're constantly pursuing and evolving in that direction. Yes. I've probably said too
much. No, you're spot on. And this is why you're so much fun to talk to. And we got to have you on the show again, because there's never going to be enough time to unpack everything we talked about. But I'll tell you this, folks that are listening, stop trying to rename shit that you already know. So what Chip has been talking about for the last 5, 6, 7 minutes is resilience born from experience. Okay. Which is also a way of saying tacit knowledge. But now the word is grit. He's got the grit. You know what I'm saying? So I get it, but stop worrying about that. What you did is you talked about consequences in that story, which is a compelling story. It changed me. And you talked about being tactically sound in a situation, yet operationally, you made a difference and you met the strategic objectives of your agency. Why is that important? Because I come in at night, I'm going to be working Charlie 50 car, 2-man car tonight. I'm excited. I want to hit the streets and I want to make a difference in my district. Watch commander comes up and goes, hey, you're watching this guy at the hospital. What guy? Knee guy. I'm watching knee guy. Why? That's Hoots Caper. You catch him, you clean him. That sound familiar, Chip? Okay. And so what you don't understand is what you do and what you don't do matters in your entire community and in your off-duty roll call and with your wife and kids. And I want to throw one more thing in, Brian. I'm going to turn it back over to you. I'm a person that likes to unpack quotes when I hear a good one. And I'm going to butcher your quote. But you made a quote in writing. Or in person at one time, and I dug it up, and it was, you know, even a compliment can seem condescending when it's not genuine. There's your compassion and empathy right there, because we're coppers. We're on transmit. When we learn Spanish, it's command Spanish. When I come into your house, I'm not asking you, do you mind if I come in? Let's move away from the door. You're not free to leave. And that authority overwhelms us sometimes, and we forget our humility and we forget our compassion and empathy. You've got it in spades. You got to keep doing what you're doing. I'm proud that we got you on the call. I mean, Brian, I'm looking, it's like an hour. I'm like, oh my God, where did the time go? I thought we just got introduced. So
Greg, I've got, in full disclosure, I appreciate your compliments. I really struggle still with the basics of our work. I mean, there's still days when, you know, I slip up. I'm not as patient as I should be. You know, I try to force my opinions on people. You know, there's days when with my 16-year-old stepson, it's such a gift to have him in my life, because he is naturally resistant to feedback. And, you know, it's just an opportunity to constantly work, you know. And I mean, he's taught me things when I've shut up and listened. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like I'm riding in the car with this kid and I'm like, you know, the old me says, what's a 16-year-old got to tell me? I mean, I was in the Army at 17. Like, he's what's this kid know? He plays video games and baseball. But when I shut up and I'm just like, listen to this kid, you know, I mean, he's actually taught me things. True. But I want to be honest with your listeners and with you too. Some days I wake up in the box. Some days I wake up just totally self-absorbed in my own stuff. And I do the most inconsiderate things. And I think that what Arbinger's gifted me is the ability to recognize it more quickly and recover.
Yeah.
To be able to say, that's pretty inward. Who do I need to apologize to? What do I need to do differently? You know, I can start asking some of those questions, but I don't want to give you the impression, not that you would ever be fooled into thinking this, that I've arrived anywhere, because I'm on this journey.
You know that mankind chart where they show like the fish, then the monkey, then the bird, then the T-Rex, then the caveman. I didn't go to school very long.
I don't think you did that in the right order,
but then Homer Simpson. The idea is that we're all on that path, and I'm somewhere. Just saying that you're further along than a lot of the people I have to deal with every day. And
gracias,
I like that.
My friend. Gracias.
And you brought up a really good point there too, that I was trying to use examples too, because, you know, we, especially if we're training like military or law enforcement, whatever, like, I'm like, all right, well, not going to use examples from that. I can tell you all kinds of Marine sniper stories and that may be relevant, but like, what am I really trying to do? So I call her the insurgent. I got an 11-year-old here at home, 11 going on like 15. So I'll use those stories because it's the same thing. You're just like,
same.
It's the most challenging because it's no different than dealing with someone through a different language. Like I've used those experiences from trying to, you know, get through the little Gulf Arabic that I know in a hostile environment, talk to someone. It's the same thing talking to 11-year-old. I'm like, what is she really trying to say to me? Like, of course this is the worst thing, but I have to figure out, is this the worst thing that's happened to her? Or is this just in the moment right now? And I have to determine that, because I had to learn that, because some things my wife had to be like, hey, you know, especially when she's younger, like, hey, she's 5. We bring down that conversation a little bit. I was like, oh, I see what you're saying. She had no clue. And I was like, no, why don't we bring down a 5-year-old? And it's so funny. So I literally have to like get down on my knees and be like, all right, now I see the world. Okay, here's where we're at here. And it's so funny because I tell people, just using, if you have children, that's the best way. Yep. You know, we, even when we get into talking about body language and different stuff that everyone loves talking about, which we do a little bit of just the stuff that you can tell, but like, you know, it's great with kids, or like deception indicators, like they're not good at lying yet. So if you can learn, it's almost like watching an adult lie, but in slow motion, you're like, oh, now I see it. You're totally making this up. But with kids, you can see it right there. And it's the same thing. It's that constant ego check when like, she just has that response to something and you're like, I'm telling you to do this. Why aren't you doing it? Like you're supposed to listen to me. This is how this works. Like, what are you talking about? And so that constant, and I just call it the ego check. And I'm just like, all right, how do I got to do this? And, you know, especially if we're in here, we're dealing with a lot and we, you know, have clients and we're on calls and dealing with stressful stuff. And we got this, we're booking travel and so busy. And then like, when I walk outside this room and I go in that house, I cannot take this in there. Like, that's not fair to them, right? That's my stuff. I signed up for that. That's my life. That's not my wife and my daughter's life and my son's life. Now, like, that's different. So having that sort of, you know, ability to do that, is really, really important.
Yeah.
Makes my life much better if I can check myself at that door before I walk back in, you know.
But my friend Mitch recommended a book to me by Sam Harris called Lying. Sam Harris writes a lot of short books, and so, you know, if you like short books, but Lying, it's an interesting little book, but there's a story in there about kid, and you talked about not being good liars, and basically the parent you know, meets this couple at the door that come to stay with them for the weekend, and they say, hey, we really appreciate you letting us stay there. And the kid's with the parent, and the parent's like, hey, absolutely, of course, and no problem. And the kid said, well, that's not what you said a while ago, Daddy. You said they would get a hotel, and it goes down this whole No, you misunderstood me. No, I didn't understand. You said, and so everybody sitting there all awkward, but it's a good point. The point he's making is that the kids are watching us. What are we teaching them? Right. And I think by your patience and your ability to do the things you're doing intentionally with them, I think it's a hallmark of a good parent when the little emotional crises that you look at as being no big deal, they think it's the worst thing that ever happened. The reason they think that is you provided a very safe, loving environment for them. That probably is the worst.
Well, that's the thing is, like, you have to look at it as, like, you know, from my perspective, it's like, well, this isn't a big deal. And then it's like, no, to that person, like, this is a big deal. And I mean, that's what I've always say. And that comes into everything. You know, it's like, look, man, like, I'm the guy, like, there's no one shooting at us right now. There's no bombs going off. Like, I'm good, you know, until we get to that point. So then it's like, no, you have to.
There's
be like,
people there are people climbing Kilimanjaro with no legs.
Yeah.
You and I don't have a problem.
Yeah. Like, what could possibly go wrong? But like that other person is like, no, they're in the moment. And that's the most important thing. And and being like, oh, yeah, OK, this is the most important thing to you.
You got
to
meet them where they're at.
Some
got to meet them where they're at.
Yeah. Yeah. And
it's awesome.
So yeah, the kids one is always great to use. If you're listening, you them out there, because you just got like it's in slow motion. So it's like practice. It's the best practice for adults and dealing with people. And, you know, it's always fun. I always have, you know, hanging out with them and teaching her stuff is great. My mom's like, oh, it's like, well, yeah, you teach, you know, that's I was like, oh, kids, I'd rather teach kids all day. I got to teach adults, and they think they know everything, and they don't.
They do.
At least kids know like that there's a experience level difference, you know. That's assumed. Like with adults, it's like, oh no, adults think they know everything. I'd rather teach kids all day long. but yeah, so I really appreciate you coming on, Chip,
yes,
and sharing the experiences, and you know, talk about how it affects you personally, organizationally, tactically. Like that's the whole thing. Is I love anything where you can apply to the most amount of situations or all situations, because it's the most utile thing to use, and that's the whole point. And when it comes to even training, and you know how that is too, I don't care with what you're training or learning. What do we typically do? We put the training hat on. Now we're training. And it's like, I get that for certain skills that you have to learn. But with this isn't about putting the hat on. This is always on. This is something that you're
taking the coat off. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And this is something that you're always carrying around with you. This isn't now we do this. Now we use it in this situation. It's how do I use this effectively all the time? And then you start building, you know, those heuristics, start building those cognition biases to now you default to this positive way of looking at the situation versus defaulting to, oh, you're not going to do what I say? Okay. You know what I mean? Which is what we all want to do in those situations. Like, I'm going to take you to the ground right now. It's like, oh, maybe I can wait a minute here and try a few other options. So I just appreciate you sharing that from those multiple perspectives, because it's really, really powerful. And Greg, I don't know, I'll let you kind of get some.
I'd like to say one thing. And Brian, if it's okay, we'll give Chip the last word before you close out. Brian brought up something great that Chip has been alluding to during the entire episode. Look, folks, if you're listening and watching and you're still with us at this time, I carried three sets of cuffs on my gun belt all the time, two sets of Hyatt hinged and a Smith & Wesson chain. And every day before I went home, every day of my career, I went by the hospital and I put them in an autoclave to make sure that they were clean for the next time that I had to go out on the road. But every day I came home, I still wore my Danner Go Devil boots into the house. That's how stupid I was, because I didn't understand that I was still poisoning that environment. It took me over 30 years to look back on that and go, oh my gosh, I was saying, but I wasn't doing. So what we're talking about is aligning your thoughts and aligning your self-awareness and making it fit this environment through the baseline by looking up and out and every once in a while down and in. But great stuff. I hope that made sense to some of the coppers in the crowd, and they learn it, and it doesn't take them 30 years.
Yeah. Chip, I'll give you kind of the last words here before we wrap.
Yeah, you know, there's so many things that you could say to wrap something up, but I guess if just talking to the audience, I would suggest that a lot of the people that I've worked with over the years that were resistant to the idea of being compassionate or seeing others as people or being curious, they were on the exterior, they appear to be very tough people, you know, really rough. They got the tats, you know, they got the gym muscles. They've done all that, you know, they've been downrange a few times. And, you know, I understand that, defensiveness. I understand that insecurity that sometimes causes us to project our attitudes, our domination out onto the world, right? But the thing that I would leave the listeners with is, you know, looking tough is a 10-minute class. Mm-hmm. You know, being tough is a lifelong yep. pursuit. And the way we are tough, you know, that takes a lot of work, a lot of hours of training, a lot of skill building. It's not talking down to people. It's not demeaning them. It's not, you know, running people over like a bulldozer. You know, the toughest people I know are the most compassionate people. Yep. They lead with the heart, you know, and if things go down, they are ready to yep. roll. And they're perfectly equipped to do whatever they need to do. But, you know, my closing thought would just be, you know, what I wish for everyone is that we get in touch with, you know, with ourselves and recognize our limitations as humans. And that way we'll be able to more closely relate to the other people around us in helpful ways. And I appreciate you gentlemen and the work you're doing. And you certainly won Jack over and
thanks. You
know, yeah. Jack has been impressed. I've looked now, he shared with me some diagrams, some things that you guys were teaching. I'm like, wow, this makes so much sense. So thank you for what you're doing. And yeah, if you'll ever have me back on, I'd love to chat some more.
Yeah, we definitely love to. I think we could probably deep dive something in the future. And I guess we should give Jack the shout out for the link up, Jack, and for linking up with us. Yeah. And he's very effective. He's a deep thinker, and we appreciate him so much, because it's same thing about him that you can tell, like, man, this guy's a really deep thinker. He's a yeah. really compassionate person. He's amazing. But then at the same time, I'm like, he would not hesitate to kill me if I stepped out of line. Like, I have that, you know what I mean? Like, I just instantly, like, I'm like, this guy's been through, he knows how to handle himself. You yeah, get Jack, it right away.
Jack is amazing. And listen, if we find ourselves in Kansas City or in this area at the same time, yeah. let me know. We'll all go out and grab some barbecue and catch up. And, you know, I'll make up some line war stories that I can share, and you know, I'll think of something sexy here.
That's so great. That's yeah. great. And I would throw this back at you. Let's collaborate with something. We've always wanted yeah. to collaborate with Harbinger. Okay. We know that something might be in the works. We don't know. We the same with Jack. Jack was coming to our training. It was great. We want to see him again. And Chip, like-minded people, birds of a feather. We want to see you again too. This was great.
Yeah. Okay, yep, we appreciate it. Thanks everyone for tuning in. We'll have all the links for Harbinger, some of the stuff we talked about, and to link up to reach out with Chip as well. And you know, that'll all be in the episode details. So please check that out. And then if you have any other questions, of course, always reach out to us, leftofgreg@gmail.com. And don't forget that training changes behavior.
That's all for today, folks. But if you'd like even more content, you can head over to our Patreon page. The link can be found in the episode details. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, follow us on social media, and please tell your friends about the show. Thanks for tuning in, and thank you for your support.